Welcome to the People of Relic and EKR podcast, where you're going to hear the stories of the people that work at these two amazing advertising agencies. Relic focuses on tourism, and EKR works with a variety of businesses to help people get the right message to the right people at the right time. And we have amazing people in our organization, and I am going to interview them to hear the unique stories and backgrounds that they have to help you better get to know the people of Relic and EKR. Jared Price, thanks for joining me on the People of Relic and EKR podcast.
Thank you for having me, Adam.
Absolutely. You know, I saw you walking out on the street, and I thought, let's get this guy. First, let's get him a job, and then let's bring him in studio.
It's perfect timing, because I just woke up. It's 2 p.m., which is good for me.
Well, honestly, probably a step in the right direction.
You've urged me to turn a new leaf just since half hour ago.
Okay, jokes aside, I think we went as far as we could with that one. What's your role here?
JP. I am the director of the business development team.
And so, you've been here how long?
3 years.
Yeah, you just had an anniversary.
I did, 2 days ago.
Congratulations, yeah. By the way.
Thank you very much. Yeah. It's been quite the ride. I can't believe it's only 3 years. I feel like we've been through a lot together.
We have been through a lot together. Yeah, we'll have to talk about that a little bit today. So if I ask you the question, who is Jared Price? What's the answer to that question?
Ooh. I am just a normal dude trying to figure things out, learn as much as I can, and be as kind as I can to people I encounter.
Really? So just at first glance, I probably wouldn't – the last part about being kind, I wouldn't have assumed that that was one of your goals.
Just everyone except my boss.
I'm just kidding. No, that's interesting, actually. That might be one of the more interesting answers I've received, not because – you know, it's anything crazy. It's just you didn't describe any overarching goals of where you're trying to reach or, you know, you defined yourself as just what you're trying to do every day, which I think is an interesting answer to that question.
Yeah, it's I'm of the opinion that everything, including myself, is a work in progress. And in order to do that, I think you just need to be cognizant and present in the moment.
Interesting. Okay. What do you think has caused you to have that perspective?
That's an interesting question.
Thank you.
I think it's a combination of people I love and respect in my life, seeing their example, and also just wanting to leave something positive behind. I mean, hopefully I'm not near death, but
yeah, I was gonna say that's ominous.
Yeah. Dun dun dun.
No, that's really interesting, JP. And, you know, to clarify for those listening, I actually can attest to a lot of the things that you're saying because I see it in kind of your everyday practice. And it's interesting to hear you articulate your philosophy because I see it in practice. I don't know. It's fascinating to me.
Thank you. You got that recorded, right? I'm going to put that on loop.
I said fascinating, not positive, right? So I just want to make
sure. It's not accurate, but fascinating. That's how you think of yourself?
Let's talk a little bit about your background, JP. I want to hear kind of your upbringing and what led you to where you are today.
Yeah, sure thing. So I am pretty homegrown Utah. I kept trying to leave, kept coming back. And then it's finally like, oh, well, it's time to admit I like this place.
What does trying to leave look like?
You name it. Boats, planes. Crates in the cargo holds.
Thank you. Any destination in particular or just wherever the truck was going?
Wherever the truck was going. No, I always had big dreams of fleeing to the coast, either L.A. or New York. And then, you know, I think as life progressed, my goals changed and those objectives. And I realized that kind of high intensity, high speed lifestyle that I was looking forward to and working toward just wasn't in the cards for me.
What was the high-speed lifestyle?
Yeah, it's I always wanted to pursue a, you know, there's a bit of anti-conformist in me, and I wanted to pursue a music career where, you know, I was in a phase of the 9-to-5 is evil, and, you know, there's only one thing in life for me. And, you know, I did all that I could to put myself on that trajectory.
How'd you get into music?
So I was actually took piano lessons. Well, here's the thing. It all started 2002 Olympics, and my uncle took me to see the Bare Naked Ladies. My first band. Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah, just want to make sure. Right. I don't want this to get categorized as the NSFW category of podcasts. So the band Bare Naked Ladies at the Olympics.
That could be a damaging soundbite. So thank you for clarifying there.
What an uncle.
What an uncle. That's for sure. you know, all right. Regaining composure here. You know, I had taken piano lessons growing up, and it was like, all right, this is fun. You know, the story of every kid who's taken piano lessons, pretty much. But then, you know, seeing that show made concrete that abstract expression of music. It's like, okay, well, I've been kind of, you know, dinking around here on the black and white keys, but this is what it looks like in a larger context. You know, there's something really exciting about seeing people on stage together, and, you know, what they're producing is kind of greater than the sum of all parts. And so that was Awakening sounds dramatic, but I guess something of that sort. And anyway, from that point, you know, I played French horn in high school.
Was that just like you thought it looked like an interesting instrument? You thought you'd try it out, or what led to the French horn?
Sixth grade, band day. They brought all these doe-eyed kids in to look at instruments and choose your fate. And I picked the French horn because it looked nice.
Nice. It was graceful. The sixth grade band day, I chose the bass clarinet.
See, that's where we differ.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm glad we can both look back on that.
Both woodwinds with a little bit of an odd shape.
No.
What's the French horn?
French horn is the... I'm making hand motions for
okay,
everyone.
It's got like a trumpet connection
yeah,
type.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'm visualizing it now. Okay. Started with the French horn after the piano. Where did your music career evolve from there?
Well, marching band was the first step to greatness. Now, I played in the marching band there.
French
American
horn.
Fork High School.
In the marching band.
Well, it was a mellophone, the marching version.
Is that the marching version of a French horn?
Yeah, you could say that. But I got bored with that. I had some friends who were putting a little band together, and I picked up a bass guitar. And that was kind of where I found home then for the next decade and a half.
Did you slap at the bass?
I was never good at slap at the bass, but I did a good job plucking it.
Okay.
Not as exciting.
Nice. That's a movie reference for those listening. We'll find it. Okay, so you started playing the bass guitar.
Yeah, because I had noodled around on my dad's old acoustic guitar for a little bit, but nothing serious by any means. But I got a bass. Started playing with some friends, and it really occupied an interesting intersection of melody and rhythm.
Hmm.
You know, they kind of call it the pocket there, where you're still providing foundational chord support, but also you're part of the rhythm section. I really liked working hand in hand with the drums.
Interesting. All right.
Yeah.
You know what's funny is I can just hear in your description your passion for music. It's not just, oh, I played the bass guitar. It's that I was in this interesting intersection between the percussion and the, well, it's not percussion in the type of band that you're in, but I don't know. It's interesting to hear the way you talk about it. Music seems pretty important to you.
It's extremely important to me. And still, I don't play as often as I used to. You know, did a lot of recording and touring. Nothing grandiose by any means, but.
Well, no, I actually, you and I have talked a lot about this, and I think it's important for people to know that your band was not just some garage band that didn't do anything. You guys came pretty close to a successful band career, right?
Adam, have you heard of the Beatles? They have nothing to do with what I'm about to say next.
I have heard of the Beatles, yes.
We had a lot of good things going, and it seemed as though things were in place that we could start doing it a little bit more than full-time. So we were all working, you know, jobs at pizza places and things. And then it just kind of stopped there. People changed priorities, myself including.
You mean band members?
Band members, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, and I think myself, too. As I got into it, I started to realize that, okay, this looked fun and exciting. But then getting a taste of it, it just seemed like too much.
Were you already married when you kind of stopped with the band activity, or is that something that came later?
No, that was something that came later. In fact, I met my wife kind of at the tail end, and things made more sense when she came into my life, and I realized that that was where I belonged. Not like it was a trade-off by any means, but...
Priorities changed.
Yeah, and it was, you know, a clarification when I met her about what I wanted to do with myself.
Interesting.
Leave this pause in.
So one of the things I've tried to ask everybody that's kind of come on the show is there a formative childhood memory that you feel like had a big impact on who you are today?
I think something that really changed things for me at a young age. I was 10. And my baby sister was born. She had Down syndrome. And it was interesting being a 10-year-old as things, you know, as you start to mature a little bit. I mean, not like I was a mature 10-year-old, but I liked Pokemon and things. But you're starting to piece the world together. And this was an element of things that, an element of life that few people shared with me. I didn't really have that in common with my friends. And, you know, it was something that made me view the world differently than perhaps I would have otherwise.
Tell me about that. What do you mean by that?
You should have printed these out before.
I had no idea where this was going.
You and me both. As a 10-year-old, it forced me to get out of my own mind, where suddenly, instead of seeing things solely from my perspective, it was kind of like I was more of an outside observer of things that were going around me. And so maybe it was a decentering of sorts, turning from, you know, a self-absorbed 10-year-old into starting to look at things that were around me, being more aware of that, being more aware of different people's experiences. And it shook things for me.
You know, it's interesting that you talk about that, because as I've gotten to know you, I think you're one of the more empathetic people that I've worked with professionally, and it seems like that may have been some of the originating factors that led to the empathy that you demonstrate.
Well, thanks, because empathy is definitely something that I try to embody.
All right. So we've talked a lot about kind of your past, your upbringing, music, obviously a very important part of your life as you grow up. Let's talk about today. What are you doing today, and maybe even a little bit of the professional background that led you to today?
Yeah. So there were two things that I said I'd never do, sales or marketing. And now I'm selling marketing, which is exciting. The good news is that I like it more than I ever thought I would. I'd always kind of had an affinity for writing and saw myself going into a field that had something to do with that, you know, just in the horrible case I had to do something with my life just besides play music. So it's like, all right, well, what do I do with it? Something that I liked from writing is that when employed correctly, you can see tangible change and results from it. This is my corny anecdote of a professor I had in college where he was talking to us about the power writing can have. And he says, if you really want to make things happen in the world, you got to, what do you say? I never went to college. Okay, we're going to rewind a little bit.
I wish we wouldn't.
So I ended up at UVU. I took the scenic route through school. And they had a program called Writing Studies. And I had a professor that really made a lasting impression on me when he said that grant and proposal writing is the language of revolution, because if you can influence where resources go, you know, money, manpower, materials, with these proposals, you can see change evinced by the work directly. So I had an aha moment where writing was great for me, but it was a kind of abstract. And then getting into that, it became, I'm doing this because I can see this result, which is also very satisfying to me. And so, you know, my emphasis was in grant and proposal writing. Started working out as a proposal writer. Really, it started to enjoy kind of the strategy behind some of those proposals instead of just, you know, kind of regurgitating the standard there. And I think that's kind of how I ended up where I am now.
Okay. And that was about 3 years ago. You came in as a proposal writer.
Yeah, yeah, for EKR. I had worked at another company before, right after graduation, for about a year and a half, writing proposals. And it was fun. It was fun. That's still something that I really enjoy doing. And, you know, anyone who's ever worked with an RFP, of course, there's always some obligatory comments about how horrible this response is. But there's something in me that still has a good time kind of piecing together that puzzle.
Yeah. Okay, so now you're the director of business development at Relic and EKR. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts on the role that you have now versus coming in as a proposal writer, and maybe some of the biggest wins that your team has had that you have, you know, that you've felt pretty excited about.
Yeah, it's been interesting morphing into, you know, a client facing sales position, and something that I've taken to heart and tried to apply on a day-to-day basis, because, you know, I was a big fan of like rhetoric and studying of that, all that kind of stuff. It was either Cicero or Cato the Elder.
I can't help you here.
Nor can I. Anyway, an old Roman, he said, the ideal orator is, the phrase in Latin is vir bonus decendi peritus, which means the good man speaking well. And that was something that I wanted to take into not only my personal life, but also in a professional context, where just demonstrating that, demonstrating goodwill to the client and helping them solve problems and not just try to, you know, get a signature or something, but acting truly as a, you know, in a consultative capacity with an eye toward results that the client's going to they need for their organization.
I think that philosophy has really contributed to your success in our organization, because it's pretty disarming when you can tell that the salesperson is not just blindly trying to sell you on whatever they can, but they're actually trying to figure something out that's going to help you as a person and your organization. And that really does come through in your pitches. I don't know. It's kind of fun to watch, because I never knew the philosophy that you're kind of embodying as you go into that, from Cicero or Times New Roman, whichever one that was.
He's a great guy too. Times, and, yeah.
Oh yeah, that's his first
Mr. New Roman, as I know him.
But it's interesting to watch that kind of come to life, because I think you embody that, and you have also trained your team on that, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, something that we always say is that we're the non-salesy sales team. Because, I mean, going back to the things I never thought I'd see myself doing, getting to a sales role, there's a stigma surrounding that, I think, because of, you know, years and years of harmful practices where people, you know, that's their perception of a salesperson. They've got some kind of ulterior motive, but really the motive that works best for both client and, you know, agency success here is accurately diagnosing that problem and providing a solution that addresses that completely.
Yeah. Tell me some of your kind of most rewarding wins that you've had over the years.
I think something, Adam, this is before the Relic EKR merge, but we had worked together closely on it. You know, a massive project for Temple Square in Salt Lake City. And that was, you know, really beefy proposal, 120 pages or something. But it was crafted very meticulously. You know, not just me, but everybody on the team helped bring that together. And that was, you know, proposals I'd written in the past. It's like, okay, this is cool, sure. But this is something I was really proud of. You know, we won that deal, and then COVID had other plans, of course, for fulfilling on it. But that was cool. That was cool. A couple other recent ones. Dana Point, California. That was another cool one to help have a part in. Again, you know, the thing that's cool about my job as well is that it's never just a one-person effort. You know, it's really cool to see Callie and Michaela on my team really run with that. You know, Adam, I think you were involved a little bit.
I can't remember.
Yeah,
no, was one of the more fun ones that we put together for sure.
Yeah, it was. And so, you know, Dana Point, it's one of my favorite places in the world, really. And so it was fun to see, you know, a little bit of my efforts bring that a little closer to home here.
Yeah, I like that. All right. I think we've got a pretty good grasp on what you do and how it works within the agency. Let's talk about your hopes and dreams, Jerry Price. What's your vision for you for the future?
Trying to survive my three children under five. No, just kidding. I told myself I wouldn't say that here on the podcast because they're beautiful creatures and they're my pride and joy.
I think creature's the operative word there, though, right? Parent of young children.
Ankle biters, if you will. You know, my kids and my family right now, they're everything to me. And so I think that my goals right now are all pertaining to their happiness, comfort, and success.
Yeah. How do you do that?
Oh, gosh. If I figure it out, I'll let you know. But just kind of keep working at it.
I mean, do you see yourself fulfilling on that as being a provider, or is it? And you and I have talked a little bit about philosophy on parenting. Either I know that you're a very involved parent.
Yeah, yeah. It's always been important to me to have, play a big part in my kids' lives. And my wife Alyssa and I, we've gotten a good place where it does feel like, you know, a co-parenting situation. She definitely takes the lion's share, but it's nice to be involved, see them grow up, see them learn, hear them say those naughty words when I didn't think they were listening to me, fix the car. But it's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Just being involved. Yeah.
I like that. All right. Is there anything I haven't asked you, JP, that you think would be good for people that work with you or might work with you in the future for them to know as they get to know you better?
I'm sorry. That's it. I can have a grading personality.
Grading? Like it grates on you?
Like a cheese grater. Yeah.
Okay, so yeah. Just an apology in advance.
Just an apology in advance.
Okay, and
probably
that's...
Probably too late for some, but in advance for others.
Me included.
You especially.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, no, it's been great to have this conversation, JP, and definitely appreciate your contribution to our organization. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you. This has been insightful and making me wonder why I say some of the things I do.
Well, hopefully we helped. This is one of the many stories of the people of Relic and EKR. I hope you'll stick with us and listen to the other stories that we release on a weekly basis and get to know our whole team. We've got some amazing people here, and we hope you enjoy it.